Hey everybody, it's another edition of the Shay Anything podcast. Doug Williams alongside Andy Martino. Andy, fresh from Cleveland.
I wouldn't say fresh.
You're not fresh, but you are just back from Cleveland.
I'm as fresh as you can be for working so hard and traveling in a week because it was a stimulating experience. It was an interesting couple days relative certainly to most All-Star games, which are boring. This one was not boring.
One of your answers on Baseball Night in New York was funny. It was the morning after, not the morning after, the day after the Home Run Derby. And you, in your answer to me about kind of the energy that Alonso had and what it was like interviewing him after he won the Derby, mm-hmm. you were like, you know me, Doug. You know how little joy get out of the All-Star game and this type of experience. And then you said, you know, but he had an aura about him that was interesting, and I'm sure it was cool to interview him after the event and after the All-Star game eventually. So what were your impressions?
Yeah, it had... I can't remember if I said this in this conversation on BNNY last week or somewhere else, but it struck me during that Home Run Derby and after that this is why we watch sports. It had the emotions for why we watch sports, which is spontaneity, enjoyment, emotion. People who wanted to win were enjoying it, were respecting the competition. The camaraderie between Vlad Guerrero Jr. and Jock Peterson during that great round was the big hug they had was nice. And So there was a lot there. Usually the Home Run Derby, it's improved in recent years. The Judge Stanton one was, and Bryce Harper in Washington, those have had some drama. So I will give it that as someone who's hated that event for a long time. But this one, I was there. Alonso emerged as a really fun character in the game. And he and McNeil, who were there for the first time, just could not have been better ambassadors for the Mets or more accommodating. They gave us all the time we needed as SNY and then the newspaper reporters too. And they were people who, they weren't like, oh, what do you want from me, as some athletes get. And, you know, it's still early in their careers, so I hope neither of them get that way. But they were so into just the event, representing themselves, representing the Mets, and having fun. And I just cannot compliment Alonzo McNeil enough for the way they embraced their first All-Star game. I was trying to do something different, so I interviewed them about each other. We had some time with them on media day, so I was like, I'm going to ask you guys questions about each other to do something a little different. And they were game for that, and they were laughing about stuff. I think we showed that on BNNY.
Yep, it was on the show.
So just little things. They were just up for anything. And then Alonso's got that clutch gene. He really does. You could see it. When he didn't have that great a performance in the Derby, like relative to some of the other guys, in some ways, he just hit enough home runs in each round, right? And he started out most of the rounds kind of weak. So you're thinking out this, even the first round against Santana, you're like, oh wow, Santana hardly hit any home runs, like 14 or something in that round, and he's going to advance because Alonso and his poor cousin have nothing going on here.
his cousin was throwing up sliders.
Yeah, but then he did it. And he bumps chests with his cousins, which is funny. You know, these two kids that have played together in the backyard when they were kids. I thought that was really nice. I didn't really like all the Twitter snark about his cousin. Because it's like, so what if the guy loses him the Home Run Derby? This is really cool. These guys grew up together. And now they're on the field in a major league game on national TV in this moment. So I thought that was cool whether it had worked out or not. And it was just nice. And then in the next two rounds, he was behind initially over the first minute or two. And once he got to within like four or five home runs of whoever, I think he faced Ronald Acuna Jr. and then, of course, Guerrero Jr. in the next subsequent two rounds. And each time, you could see that clutch vibe from him, and I thought, yeah, he's got this. This is like when he was four, you may have had the same thought. When he was four or five away with maybe a minute left or whatever it was, I'm like, nah, he's good, he's got this. You just knew. So I give him credit for that because there are players, this is the most unanalytic thing ever, but there are players who exude that vibe. Like when you watch DeGrom with men on base, you're like, he's got this most likely. It was the same kind of vibe. So I couldn't have been more impressed with Pete Alonso. He was great. And McNeil was great too in terms of the way he handled the whole thing. And that's not to slight DeGrom. Jacob DeGrom's just a little bit of a curmudgeon.
It's his third time.
He's 31. He did what we needed him to do from a media standpoint, and he enjoyed his time in the game. And it was really nice watching him with his kids. Like, one of the things that's so different and nice about the All-Star game is that you can see mid-game, a lot of media goes down to the tunnel outside the clubhouse because players are available as they come out. So you can see guys like DeGrom, Freddie Freeman, Clayton Kershaw come out and their families, their kids are there. Most of them have like toddlers because they're that age. And the kids run up to them, jump in their arms, and you can see that the players are really proud. It's like, I'm an all-star. My father and my mother are over there. My two little kids are over here. My wife is here. And it's just all that part of it's very genuine. Not to sound too corny about it, but so DeGrom, we saw him with little Jackson DeGrom, like holding him while he was posing for pictures. It's just, you know, nice. Nice
stuff.
It's
a different side of the players than you see covering the regular season. And, you know, we talked about it on this podcast. We talk about it on the show all the time going into the All-Star game. But one of the – what I thought was really impressive of Alonso was that he was genuinely himself as a rookie in that experience. Like, he could have just been very timid and said, I'm just going to blend in. I want – this is about the guys that, you know, are the superstars of the game. He just was loud, rambunctious. Yeah. He was Pete Alonso. And I think we've talked – what I meant to say is – you know, we talked before the All-Star game about the fact that he had deserved to be a bigger star in the game than he actually was because, you know, the Mets have had a rough year and he's had an incredible year. And at times the Mets' issues, the turbulence has kind of outshined what he's been doing. And I think now that's less of a conversation because of what he was able to do on the national stage, not just the way he performed. And you saw the defensive plays in the All-Star game. You saw his two-run hit in the All-Star game, the home run derby, obviously. So that conversation's changed. And it's all to his credit for just being himself, which
is... And being himself, it's an interesting... I was talking about this with some people in the locker room. And the way... So I... asked Alonso at the very end of the game, my last availability with him, I asked him, do you see yourself as a part of, like I pointed, I think, at Acuna and Bellinger and something, do you see yourself as a part of this young generation that's going to have some fun out there and not worry so much about these debates over sportsmanship and bat, whatever, however I word it, he's like, yes, I'm one of those guys, blah, blah, blah. He says things that almost if you read the quotes, you'd be like, oh, that guy's kind of cocky. He's kind of full of himself. But he delivers it in a way that is not off-putting somehow. It's very engaging. And it's like you said, Doug, you could be a rookie and go there and be like, oh, my, those guys have already accomplished so much in the league. And
I'm
just trying
to be quiet. And
that's not him.
No.
And in a lot of people, that would come off as arrogant and off-putting. But I'm telling you, and I think fans get this feeling on TV, and I certainly get it in person, that Alonso just... he says those things in a way where it's not like he's false bravado, but he just, that's who he is. He's going to have fun with it.
So before we get into what's next, obviously we're moving into the second half, but want to go through kind of a quick look back at the first half. And obviously I used the word turbulent earlier. I think that's as good an adjective as you can use when describing what the Mets have gone through. They're 10 games under 500. And I know you didn't prepare for these, so I do want to get your honest assessment of kind of as we run through the
Mets
roster.
To be clear to our listeners, I chose not to prepare
because
I like it to be spontaneous.
So I'll go first and I'm going to give my answer. It'll give you a second to decide. But our producer Jeff lined up a couple questions. Biggest disappointment. And I thought about this one for a little while thinking about it in the Mets roster because there's, to be honest, a few choices for this one to be polite about it. And I'm going with Michael Conforto.
Oh, wow. That's harsh.
Yeah, it sounds harsher than I mean it to be. He is a good player, and he's having a fine season. I guess the reason it's a disappointment to me is that I would say you know who he is at this point. And I was one of the folks who thought maybe he would be more than this. Mm-hmm. And I think the realization that he's like a 240, 250 hitter with an 850 OPS and a decent glove, that is a good baseball player, but it is not the ceiling that I thought might have been there. And for that reason, he would be my biggest disappointment because I think he was a big part of the plans that the Mets had moving forward. And it's just a different plan than I thought it might be going in.
Okay.
There are a lot more obvious answers.
I see your logic there in that you had higher expectations. Obviously, you're not saying he's the worst Mets player.
No, I mean, there are a lot more obvious choices for this one, but I'm going in the direction of we expected him to be up there, like the leader of the Mets' young core. And now he's kind of fading into the...
Yeah. Boy, there's a lot of people who, though, for me, I understand exactly what you're saying, point taken. When I think of disappointment, I think about, like, the gap between expectation and reality. And Robinson Cano was the first name that popped into my mind because I really thought that he was going to be Robinson Cano offensively for about two more years. So that's big. Obviously, Edwin Diaz, the gap between expectations and results is right there with Cano. He's been better than Cano at his job. Diaz has been better. But obviously, we know how bad it's been at several points. And honestly, like a lower key disappointment to me has been Wilson Ramos.
Yep.
Because he's not giving you nearly enough offense to justify this terrible decline in defense that he has. Several of the most important pitchers on the team would rather throw to the backup catcher. Ramos is just old enough and big enough where he's clearly not moving around great. And he hit the ball on the ground a ton the first couple months of the season. He was slugging like 300. It was crazy. And it's been a little bit better since. But that's if you think about what could have been with either Yasmani Grandal or JT Realmuto, the fact that Brody could have traded, he could have gotten Realmuto for Nimmo and Rosario. Right now, you'd sign up for that. So the catching situation is pretty disappointing.
Yeah, all the things you listed. I mean, think about it. The Lowry signing could have been LeMahieu. The Familia signing could have been any of the relievers.
Right.
Adam Ottavino, Andrew Miller. The Ramos signing could have been the trade that you mentioned or another signing of Grandal. So right now, those are all disappointing,
mm-hmm.
and none of them look great for Brody. All right, I'll let you go first on this one. Biggest bright spot, and you're not allowed to use Alonso or McNeil here
okay.
in this division.
Biggest bright spot, honestly, the first thing that popped into my mind for me personally is the replacement of the Two Boots pizza outside the press box with whatever they put in there. Whatever brand this is, but it's delicious. And as someone who lived in New York for a long time, I actually have always thought Two Boots is overrated. It's got that sesame, not like crumb stuff at the bottom.
It's cornmeal.
Got weird. Yeah, cornmeal, thank you. I don't know why I wanted to call them sesame seeds. They're clearly not those. So I like the pizza trade up that the Mets have done.
I am going to follow up with you to get a Mets roster answer to this, though. That's been a bright spot in your life the team.
What if that is the best thing that's happened with the Mets this year?
Well,
the biggest bright spot on the field, oh my gosh, they're not that many other than Alonso and McNeil. I really have to think about this.
My answer is Dom Smith.
That's a good one. That's a really good one.
It's one of few options.
Good person who's worked hard, overcome some adversity, embraced his role, been a good teammate, really good player. So, yeah, that's a really good one. I think Zach Wheeler's been almost as good as he was last year, and despite the earned run average, and I think we'll get them a decent prospect. So I think that's been a bright spot, and it'll play out. I think Brody's got an opportunity to make a nice trade there because of Wheeler's performance, which other teams really value right now. So that's a bright spot for me. Be a brighter spot if, you know, he was pitching well for them in a pennant race.
Mm-hmm.
Not a ton of bright spots on that roster
yeah.
right now.
Yeah, I'm
DJ LeMahieu has been. Oh, no, that's the. They signed Lowry.
I'm going with Dom. It was an easy choice.
I really think the pizza's the biggest one.
I think that I respect your answer. I think Dom has done everything asked of him and more. He wanted to play left in spring training, couldn't, and then suddenly, hey, go out and play left, and he's worked
yeah.
hard at it. He's offensively obviously produced. You mentioned good teammate, which I'm glad you mentioned because, you know, this Alonso thing, having someone below you in mm-hmm. the depth chart and the pecking order go so high above you and then to not only embrace it but become a good friend of that guy, it's been cool to watch, and I think he has... whether it ends up being a trade piece or a part of their team moving forward, I think that's been a really good thing for the Mets. Biggest surprise. There's a lot more options for
biggest
this
surprise?
Yeah, thing that's player whose performance has surprised you the most.
Same as my bad answer, Cano and Diaz.
Yeah. I am going, again, I thought about these for trying to keep my answers creative because there are obvious ones out there. I'm going with Syndergaard. And only because I thought that his problem was going to be staying on the field, and his problem has not been just staying on the field this year. His problem
right.
has been he's hittable. His problem has been that he struggles mechanically. His problem has been that clearly he's got some when on the mound between the ears issues. There is now, you can no longer say, when he's on the mound, he's great.
No.
Because he's been on the mound. this year, and he has struggled. So that's been a surprise to me. Are you surprised by his performance or no?
Not anymore. It's been a long time since he's been significantly better than
average. Right, but he had a 3 ERA last
year. Yeah, no, he has his moments because he's so talented. But no, I wouldn't have been surprised if he had a really good season, but this doesn't surprise me with Noah Syndergaard. This is why it made sense to trade him in the winter when they were thinking about it, because there's a part of you that could see this coming. Not that you knew this was coming, but it was on the menu of possibilities that he would continue to be just kind of okay. So that's not my biggest surprise. My biggest surprise really is the underperformance of Robinson Cano and Edwin Diaz. I really thought that was a good win-now trade, a questionable decision to trade Jared Kelnick for a reliever and an old guy who was expensive and all this. But I thought that regardless of what one thought about the trade strategy, that those two are going to be good in the short term. That's surprising to me that they haven't. I'm also surprised that Jason Vargas turned out to be kind of physically aggressive. He seems so chill.
Yeah, honestly, the Vargas's personality has been a big surprise of this
I didn't
year.
Think he would be the guy.
He had that in him. And also, honestly, Vargas's performance on the mound's been kind of surprising.
Yeah, and absolutely pleasantly surprising. I mean, this is the guy that was an all-star for the Royals.
Right.
That's why they signed him. So,
by the way, I am now totally unable to watch him pitch without thinking about you saying that his changeup is his fastball. And for anyone who doesn't follow Andy on Twitter, basically, and it's true.
We're not thinking enough about the word changeup and what it means.
Vargas's changeup is his, like, fallback pitch. That's, like, his best pitch and his most...
Right.
That's his go-to pitch, the pitch he relies on. His fastball is what he uses to surprise you. It is the opposite.
That's the changeup. So let's go back to the origin of why the pitch is called a changeup, because everyone threw fastballs, and one time a guy threw it slower, and someone said, hey, he just changed it up.
So, which is such a corny... only that guy had said something more creative.
So his fast... Wait, what did we decide? His changeup should be called his...
it's not a fastball, but...
It should be called his slow pitch. And his fastball should be called... No, it should be called his slow ball, and his fastball should be called his changeup, because he's going to throw a lot of his slow ball, and then once in a while he's going to sneak in a fastball, and you go...
Which changes it up. Gosh. Good luck watching Jason Vargas now without thinking about it, because you'll be like, 3-0 count. Number 9 hitter. I'm sure he'll throw a fastball. He'll throw his slow ball.
Look, as somebody who has to go into the Mets clubhouse this year, I just want to say... that I hope that nothing in this conversation has accidentally offended Jason Vargas. You never know.
Yeah. Okay. Least surprising.
I am least surprised by Dom Smith being good. People were underrating the heck out of him. You could see it coming, and I had the chance to see him in Vegas last year in September and talked to him a little then when he got called up after. And I just thought that he had arrived in a different place with his mindset. You pretty much knew the talent was there, and he seemed to have matured to a place where I had a conversation with him in September where he was like, at this point, like, I've failed so many times already that I'm kind of just like, in a positive way, kind of like, screw it. He didn't say screw it, but just like, what can they do to me now? Just go out there and play and have fun. And I just kind of felt like he had a good year in him. So I can say that I did feel like I saw that particular one coming a little bit.
Yeah, I've been going back and forth on what my answer to this one would be. I'm going back and forth between Nimmo and DeGrom. DeGrom, because I think this is exactly the season I would have predicted going into the year, that knowing that the baseballs are juiced or whatever's going on, and knowing that he's coming off a great year and it wasn't going to live up to that. Nimmo, Moose made a great point the other night on the show that the Mets knew what they had and yet convinced themselves after his one good year last year that he was better than the guy that they had scouted for so long in the minor league level.
Okay.
And I think him coming out and struggling for the first little while in the season and then getting hurt cannot be looked at as a surprise, because the Mets were telling us through people like you that he had a fourth outfielder.
I got to say, that wasn't the Mets. That was more like...
That was more a scout or a rival GM.
The Sandy Alderson regime, which made him their first ever top draft pick, they did always like him. And they did, when he was good, I think some of the old guard with the Alderson regime was like, see, we always said he was good. So I don't know that premise I exactly agree with. It was more like other teams, other scouts were like, who is
this guy? No, that's an important clarification. Yeah. Looking back on it, you mentioned the Rosario and Nimmo package.
I mean, oh, man, you do that in a heartbeat. And I was talking to some of the Philly writers that I know well about Real Muto at the All-Star game. He was there on the All-Star, and just he's having a little bit of a down season offensively, but just what a presence he is, good guy, good with the pitchers. He seems to have those qualities that Brody, as his former agent, knew that he had. So that was a great pickup for the Phillies and would have been a great pickup for the Mets, which Brody knew, which is why he tried to get it done.
All right, so let's move forward to the trade deadline. Obviously, it being, I guess you could say mid-July at this point, July 12th is when we're taping this. What are you hearing right now is what's next for the Mets?
Trade Zach Wheeler. That's the big thing that is probably going to happen between now and the end of July. Once you get back from the All-Star break, it's go time. It's like any time between a few days from now and a few weeks from now is the window, and that's broad, but that's the way this works out. You know, you have to see how this works with other teams. Brian Cashman who's obviously one of the GMs who's very interested in Wheeler, was on Jim Duquette's radio show this morning, which I happened to be listening to, and said something like, well, if I fill my needs now, then other teams are going to get better in like a week or two, and then I'm going to maybe wish I'd done something else. So there's this game of chicken that goes on where you want to improve your club immediately, but you also don't want to jump out too early. So that's what teams are involved in right now. But there's plenty of teams in on Wheeler. He's generating significant interest just off the top of my head. The Red Sox, the Yankees, the Brewers. I haven't heard the Braves directly, but it would stand to reason that they'd be one of the teams. I've heard the Cubs. So there's a lot of interest in Wheeler, and that's the next thing. Look, Frazier and Vargas could go. But that's not going to be a big deal. They're not going to really get anything. So
Frazier and Vargas, I feel like, are being downplayed just because if you're a team that is, you know, needs starting pitching depth to get you to the postseason, or you're a team that needs an everyday solid defensive third baseman like the Yankees were when they acquired Todd Frazier, that could get something.
No, because
package them with Wheeler.
If Marcus Stroman doesn't get you Clint Frazier, Jason Vargas?
No, I know, but you know, a top 20 prospect or something like that could end up
20 to 30 probably on another team's list. But it's going to be a guy who might help you down the road. Sometimes those guys hit, but I'm just saying it's not going to be like a big trade.
Jim Duquette mentioned last night that, you know, Frazier's a good example of somebody you could package with Wheeler.
Sure.
Like he was packaged in the trade to the Yankees.
And by the way, Cash, you remember Robinson Cano? You want him?
Yeah.
You don't have to even give him as a prospect. Just take
details.
Him.
Yeah, I know that you didn't want to sign him to an even smaller contract than the one he ended up getting.
The Yankees were on Cano right before the Mets got him this winter. The Yankees were talking about an Ellsbury for Cano thing, and we're a little interested in Cano.
Ugh. Syndergaard, offseason, too big a chip
Think... unless the Mets figure out a way to fill out the rotation next year, Syndergaard probably starts the season with them next year. When I say that I think a trade is inevitable, I mean that at some point before his free agency, he will not be extended, he will be traded. I don't think it's coming soon.
Why?
Just like the feeling in the air.
They also need bodies.
Right, next year they do.
Yeah.
And they need a little time probably to figure out. Like, the idea of trading Syndergaard before this year, you still had Wheeler, you still had Vargas, and they were talking, you remember when the Mets were talking to the Indians about Corey Kluber briefly? Mm-hmm. So it's like, all right, we trade Syndergaard, but we replace him. Now it's a little more complicated, because next year it's like, the rotation is like, let's say they trade Syndergaard, okay?
Lockett.
Jacob deGrom pitches game one, Walker Lockett pitches game two, Anthony Kay, maybe if he's ready, Doug Williams as a sinker. We get into those kind of conversations. So that's why.
How good is Doug Williams sinker conversations?
Yeah. And Syndergaard gets is really affordable next year for who he is. Mm-hmm. His arbitration number is probably somewhere around like, hold on. Someone estimated this for me yesterday. I'm going to share that estimate, which I have not shared. 8.5 to 11 million is the estimate, which Noah will get next year.
Jeff's mad because you haven't mentioned Matt's yet, but that's because
he's a reliever.
Yeah, he's a reliever suddenly. But no, we should mention Matt's, but yeah, as of right now, he's not even in their rotation.
No, fair enough. I did forget about poor Steven Matz, who's a nice man and doesn't deserve to be forgotten. But my point is that Syndergaard, his payroll slot for his ceiling it still makes sense for the Mets to start the season with him next year.
Did you name the amount? Sorry, I was
8.5 to 11 million was an informed estimate that I got on Syndergaard's number next year.
You think if his season continues the way it is now, he's an 8.5 million next year?
Yeah, somewhere in that range.
Nine.
Yeah. So
That's why
they're probably going to keep him for now.
I don't think extending him is that ridiculous an idea.
Yeah, it's just not something I see happening now, and it's not something that's in the works, so it's hard to predict that it's something that's ever going to happen.
Yeah, I don't want to repeat myself from past episode, but I just think it makes sense from a business standpoint that you have a pitcher whose value is not lower than it's ever been, but not getting higher. And I don't know.
Question is this someone you want? And that's the question they're asking, like, long term.
Right. But that's the hard part with extensions. The DeGrom extension, perfect timing. They liked the guy. Everything came together at once. But if you sign everybody to an extension at the perfect time, you're going to be spending a lot of money on those extensions, right? Mm-hmm. That's why we're starting to see a lot of guys when they're younger than you'd think of them getting extensions, getting them.
Like the trend now would almost be to talk to Alonso next spring.
Yeah, are Met fans. I've had
Syndergaard's weight on the career path for that.
I've had Met fans tweeting at me that they think Alonso should get extensions already, and you know I understand that. But
those are mostly about controlling the arbitration years and budget-wise, and maybe buying out a year or two of free agency.
Right. So, big picture, do you believe the Mets think that they have the position player talent core right now to build on in 3 years, or do you think they believe they have a team to build on next year? Like,
they're not going 3 year play.
Don't you think they realize that they are in a cycle right now where they do enough to say, "Hey, we're going to be there," and then they don't?
Well, contained in that question is your premise that that's the reality, and I think they would argue with that. I think they would say, "We don't have to take a step back. We got all this young talent right now. We've got Jacob DeGrom." And starting to enter the back end of his prime. There's a lot of things there. They're not. And keep in mind, you have a GM who just started who has a 4-year contract, I believe. He's not taking 2-3 years to step back. He wants to win.
Yes. But I just...
No, they're not going
to... It's different now. It used to be the last 5 years, it's been, we have this pitching.
Yeah, now
we have a couple good position players. We'll be fine. Now we've got the position players. We'll figure out the pitching. That is a formula that I like better. But they either have to get younger and try and build around the core for a couple years from now, or bottom line is Ramos, a lot of those disappointments you mentioned earlier, they're going to be on the team next year.
Yeah.
So how do you then turn what has been a losing formula this year into a winning one with like 80% of the same faces every day?
I don't know. I'm glad it's not my job.
Yeah, it's a tough
one. But that's what they're going to try to do.
I'm interested to see how they navigate the deadline. I know that it sounds like nothing. The picture you're painting is Wheeler, definitely, and then whatever you can get for Vargas and Frazier, you get.
Yep.
It sounds like the offseason might be more interesting than the trade deadline, but
I don't think the trade line is going to be that crazy for them. I mean, trading Zach Wheeler is a big deal. He was the guy who... begun the Sandy Alderson rebuild. He's a very symbolic person for the Mets because the Wheeler-Beltran trade in 2011 was the beginning of something else. So now that that's coming to an end, I feel that there's some meaning and some symbolism in the trade of him.
I still am curious to see. Let's say Marcus Stroman throws a pitch in 2 weeks and tears his UCL, and Zach Wheeler has a really bad couple weeks and his value plummets or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly teams are realizing... Teams like the Dodgers or the Astros or the Brewers are an even better example that are like, we are one arm away, we think, of getting this.
Syndergaard you're talking about?
Yeah. And they overpay and they call Brody and say, you know what? Screw it. I know we're getting fleeced. Here's so-and-so prospect.
Yes. If Brody can get like two really good prospects for Syndergaard, he would strongly consider, I believe, moving on it now.
Right. You're reporting.
I just don't think it's going to happen.
Right. All right.
You're right, though. It could. That's why we are mentioning his name at all.
And that's why in-season, to me, is more unpredictable because you just don't know how desperate teams are going to get. Like, if you're talking about Cashman. Cashman basically just mentioned that to Jim Ducat on the radio. He's like, you know, in 2 weeks, if I make a trade now, in 2 weeks, another team might get better or another team might get a starter that I wanted. GMs might make a bad decision.
It's a hard job. Yeah. It's a game of chicken.
All right. What'd you do on Saturday night?
I did the Mets post game.
Nice.
And then I went to bed and got up and got on a plane to Cleveland. What'd you do?
Saturday. I was in California.
Okay.
Yeah.
See you next week, folks.
As fascinating as ever. thanks for listening to the Shane Anything Podcast. Please subscribe, rate, and review if you wouldn't mind. Andy is busy today. I am busy today. He's already getting out of his chair.
I'm going to try to cram in some writing before I have to go to makeup for another thing in about 35 minutes.
Goodbye, everybody.